Your job is to tell the truth. That's your job as a journalist. And if you can't do that, you're in the wrong job.
That it wasn't my job, that it isn't our job to be popular.
It was interesting to me how they fit together as a book. I mean, I'm not nearly smart enough to have done that on purpose.
Hi all, you are very welcome to episode 58 of Behind the Lines here on The 42 with me, Gavin Cooney. Now, we're interrupting our regular programming this week to bring you a slightly different episode of the show. For those new to Behind the Lines, by the way, here's how it works. Each episode features a lengthy interview with a sports writer slash writer about their career and their favourite pieces of sports writing. On the latter, a wheezy conceit that I may have stolen from Desert Island Discs, in which each guest submits three of their favourite pieces of sports writing to discuss on air. So on this Editor's Pick special, we're going fully meta as I pick my favourite picks of our guests' picks from the series to date. So there is an absolutely huge selection to choose from. I have collated all of those picks on a PDF doc, so if you want access to an absurdly good sports writing reading list, then do get in touch with us. There are plenty of ways to do exactly that. You can email behindthelines@the42.ie. You can tweet me, I'm at GCUNY93, or just join the members' WhatsApp group. It is in that group that we swap reading recommendations and just generally chat and solve a few of the world's problems. And everyone in that group gets tipped off about upcoming guests if they do want to submit any questions or topics of conversations for them. But now on with this Editor's Picks special. So over the series to date, only Hugh McIlvany's work has been submitted more often than Paul Howard's. Paul was once at the Sunday Tribune and is now best known as the man behind Ross O'Carroll Kelly. And Paul was our guest on episode 52 this series, where he decided to talk about a stunning piece about Muhammad Ali written by Gary Smith of Sports Illustrated called Ali and His Entourage.
It's probably 12,000, 13,000 words long. And like a lot of great sports journalism, it's actually the idea. It starts with the idea. And it's actually not an interview with Muhammad Ali. It's an interview with his entourage today being 1988. And it appeared in Sports Illustrated. And he interviews, essentially there was a comet trail that followed Ali everywhere he went. And it consisted of, you know, his doctor, his logistics man, his cook, his masseur, his bodyguard, his manager, his motivator. And Gary Smith set out to find all of them, to find out what they, you know, what life was like for them now. These Where Are They Now pieces are, you know, they're hit or miss, because sometimes the story's really dull. And as it happens with this one, it was the opposite, because what's interesting about this kind of comet trail that followed Ali, everything in their lives, when you read this story, you realize that everything that happened in their lives after their involvement with Ali feels like postscript, because they traveled the world with this man, the most, you know, the greatest athlete of all time, the most charismatic athlete of all time, who almost seemed to be born for a moment in time. He was the man for the 60s, you know, his stand on Vietnam, on African-American rights, civil rights, everything about Ali was perfect. It was of the moment. And to be part of that entourage was to be, you know, to just have a privileged, have a sort of privileged view of a moment in time and when the world was changing. They met presidents, they, you know, had dinner with kings, they traveled the world, every continent with Ali. And then they all settled down to very, very normal, mostly humdrum lives, you know? And that's the kind of sadness of this piece. So, I mean, some of them, they coped, I think, some coped better than others, but there was an adjustment to be made, you know. It's like you've got the most exciting life in the world, and then you have to carve out your own identity independent of Muhammad Ali's. And you know, there's sort of seven or eight interviews here, And the one, he saves the best till last. And Bundini Brown was Muhammad Ali's kind of vibe master, really. You know, he was kind of, he wrote a lot of the poetry that Muhammad Ali used to spout, like, you know, float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. That was Bundini Brown. He was kind of a rapper, really, before his time. You know, he used to write this kind of street poetry, really. And he was Ali's vibe master. He used to just make Ali feel good about himself. He didn't really have any other role. He might have had some kind of functionary role as well. He might have been a fixer or something like that. But he was essentially Muhammad Ali's mouthpiece. And he was the one that didn't cope at all with the transition to a normal life afterwards. And it's really tragic. There's a moment in it where he's talking about how he's essentially living in one room, and he has all of these, it says he has Ali's robes from every fight he ever fought, every pair of trunks we fought in, lots of jock straps too, enough stuff to fill a museum. But it's all in a kind of lockup storage place. And he owes the place $9,000. Now, can you imagine what this stuff is worth? Ali's robes, Ali's shorts. The lot would probably fetch 25 million at auction or something today. But he owes this place $9,000. So he can't get the stuff out. And there's a tragedy in that, just a circular tragedy that he has this enormous wealth, but it's just beyond his fingertips and he can't get at it, you know? But then the postscript to this story is that it's in italics at the bottom. It says a few days later, this is after he leaves. Throughout the interview, Bundini Brown is begging him to leave because he's stirring up the sediment of old memories that he'd prefer to remain where they are. And at the end, it just says a few days later, Bundini Brown fell in his motel room and was found paralyzed from the neck down by a cleaning woman. And then he died. And it's just, it gets me every time I read that paragraph. It just gets me, you know. But it's an amazing, a really amazing piece of sports writing. And then, even though he doesn't speak to Ali in it, because at that point in his life, Ali was essentially silenced by his Parkinson's syndrome, he speaks to his doctor. And that's kind of an interesting, that's a very interesting one as well. You know, it's Ferdy Pacheco, and Ferdy Pacheco essentially says, I walked away because he wouldn't listen anymore. And I could see the cells in his kidneys were deteriorating and that this was causing his brain function to be impaired. And Dave Hannigan wrote a fantastic book about Muhammad Ali's last fight, which a lot of people think was against Larry Holmes, but he fought after the Larry Holmes fight. He fought Trevor Burbick in the Bahamas, and the book is called The Drama in Bahamas, and it's fantastic and it's well worth getting. But when you read that and you realize just how badly gone Muhammad Ali was at that point, and just how sinful it was that all these people, some of the people I mentioned in this article, were still holding onto his tail, just trying to ride the comet for, you know, another 6 months, another year. And that's part of the whole tragedy of Muhammad Ali, really.
Yeah. Because when I read the headline and when I read the first few paragraphs, like the intro has the kind of on the nose symbolism you only get away when you're writing nonfiction, in the sense that Ali is giving Gary Smith a tour of a barn outside his house where he kept all of his photos of him in his prime from the 1960s. And pigeons had nested above and shat all over the photos, basically, you know. And then I read Ali and his entourage. I thought, oh, here we're going to be talking about the people, the Don Kings of this world, who just made money out of Ali and then threw him on the scrap heap. But that element is there too. But mostly it's love. Like, I mean, they all...
These people loved him. They loved him deeply, their world, you know? And you know, I hope people can get their hands on this piece and read it, because it's just, you know, for any student of sports writing in particular, I would say read this piece, because I think I must have read it, I'd say during my career, I read it 5 times a year and always aspired to do work like this, produce work like this. But that's what's clear from the piece. They loved him. He was the center of the world. But eventually nature claims its forfeit. And, you know, and I love the way, like you, Gavin, I love the way the piece starts with this barn, all these photographs, mildew everywhere, pigeons, and it's kind of symbolic. It's kind of representative of Muhammad Ali's body, essentially, that everything breaks down. You know, nature always claims its forfeit. We all return to dust. And there's a real feeling of that. And it's a great way to set up these stories of these people whose lives essentially were, you know, were bolstered by Muhammad Ali's, but then were kind of left bereft. You know, it's like the end of a great love affair. Like, it's like, you know, Elizabeth Taylor after Richard Burton's dead. You know, it's kind of what they must have felt. You know, we've lost such a huge part of us, such a huge part of our story. Where do you go? And hers is an extraordinary story, because she's working in a high school canteen, you know, and she's sort of dishing out food, and just the ordinariness of the lives afterwards is what stays with you, really.
Yeah, we're going to actually stick with Paul for our next pick. The man has impeccable taste, because on that episode, he also discussed a piece by Paul Kimmage titled The Fatal Attraction of Thierry Claveyrollat.
I have a few folders, but I have one folder that's just full of Paul Kimmage's pieces. And this is the one. I went through it when I knew I was doing this with you today, and this is the one I remembered. I could have picked one of 10, any one of 10. That Paul wrote, but it's this one, The Fatal Attraction of Claveyrollat, that really is my favorite, mainly because it's just so personal. And Paul's an exceptional writer, and I don't think he ever writes a lazy sentence. You know, it would kill him to write a lazy sentence, or even to commit a lazy thought to print. I think it would kill Paul. He writes best, I've always found, when he's invested in a piece, when he's a player in it, and he's very much a player in this piece. Thierry Claveyrollat was a French cyclist, a two-time stage winner of the Tour de France, and a great climber, really famous climber. And he was friends with Paul when Paul was cycling. They just hit it off, and they were good friends. But they reached this breach when Paul wrote A Rough Ride, his expose of doping in cycling, and everybody turned against Paul in cycling. But very bravely, he went back to the Tour as a reporter in 1990, I think it was. He went to cover it as a journalist, and Claveyrollat cut him dead. And not just that, he launched this vitriolic attack on him that just left Paul with his mouth open. And he'd been accused at that point of, as in the parlance, of spitting in the soup. But this attack by Claveyrollat, because they were such good friends, I think really killed him. But the piece really is about the tragedy of, there's tragedy in all of these pieces I've picked. I've just wondered, I wonder, is there a reason for that? But it just, you know, tragedy just makes great writing. It's just a fact. And this particular piece, Claveyrollat, died by suicide not long after he finished cycling. And this piece really is about Paul's sadness at watching his life unravel. And we talked about it in relation to Ali's entourage, but lots of sports people who achieve great things, it's very, very difficult to transition to an ordinary life. Whatever about people hanging on coattails like Ali's entourage, this is a cyclist. Like, you know, this is a high achiever who, you know, was at the top end of his sport, and then suddenly he finds himself living this ordinary life where he's running this bar in Vizille in France. And he, you know, a series of incidents happens that brings him to the point of not wanting to live anymore. And they are that he's involved in a car crash in which a kid was blinded, and he was drunk when he was behind the wheel. So he knew he was probably going to be going to jail. He hired an illegal worker, an illegal immigrant for his bar, you know, to work as a bouncer in his bar. And the bouncer was involved in an incident. The police got involved. So he'd been charged with that. He was running this bar and the business wasn't going well. You know, he's clean, as Paul describes it, cleaning vomit and shit off the floor of the toilets every night. Didn't realize that that was actually part of owning a bar, as well as getting up early and going to bed late. And he just paints this picture of this life that's just kind of spinning out in a really sad way. And then he wins a million francs in the lottery. Yeah. He spins the wheel and he wins a million francs. And you think his life, he's going to turn this around. But he doesn't. And that's what's extraordinary about this piece of writing. And it's probably about, I'd say it's about 2,500 words long. And you know at the beginning how he dies by his own hand. And the rest of the piece, there's just an inevitability. We know the end we're coming to. And it's just so sad. And it's such an amazing piece. Right. And it's written, you know, Paul just writes with such humanity, you know, and honesty, and it's raw. And there's a moment in it where Paul, not long before he dies, Paul is in, I think it's Vizille, the town where Clavé Rolette had the bar. And Paul is standing outside the bar and he's looking in the window and he hasn't spoken to him, his old friend, since 1990. So it's probably 18 years. This piece was written in 1999, so it's 18, 19 years. And he's looking through the window of the bar and he sees the shit show that is his old friend's life. And there's two people, I think, drinking in the bar. And Paul thinks he'll go in. And then he doesn't go in. He changes his mind. And, you know, you can tell from the way it's written that Paul's not altogether happy with this decision that he made, that who knows what might have happened if he'd gone in. He speculates that Clavé Rolette would have probably opened up on him again and, you know, and nothing would have changed. But there's always that sense of not knowing, you know, what if Clavé Rolette had decided, you know, that, I think at this stage it was 1999, we'd had the Festina scandal. Nobody was in any doubt whatsoever about the realities of life as in professional cycling. Everybody was at it. Everybody was doping. And maybe, you know, maybe it would have been different if he'd called in, but it really is. It's as fine a piece of sports writing as I've ever read, I think.
Paul Howard was one of the subjects of our very first episode of this series, as the Irish Times' Malachy Clerken called into studio back in an ancient and forgotten age known as 2019. The subject was a man without whom we would not have arguably the most famous moment in all of Irish sporting history.
He went to the back arse of the back arse of Romania, yeah, in Transylvania, and found Daniel Timofti, who missed the penalty against Paddy Bonner. And for some reason, this one stayed with me more than the Nazari one. Maybe just an age thing. I was 4 for Raul Nazari. I was 12 for Timofti. So maybe that was why this stayed with me. But more than that, when you got on to me and asked me to do this and asked me to bring a couple of pieces, I was trying to work out, like, okay, what am I trying to say here? What would I use? And this, to me, just stands as the strength of an idea. Like it doesn't, like, it's brilliantly written because Paul's a brilliant writer, and it's really well explained because he drills down to it because he's a real journalist. You know, the whole social context of Romania at the time is delved into, the whole, you know, the idea that an awful lot of Romanians were much happier under communism than they were afterwards. All that kind of stuff is in it. And yet, it's a, talk about an elevator pitch, you know, going to go and find Daniel Timofti.
Mm.
Sold. go. Yeah. You know, like there's nothing else to be said there. You know, this guy who was on the other side of maybe the greatest moment in Irish sport, you know, and whatever happened to him? Who did he become? Who did he ever become? And that piece stayed with me forever afterwards.
Yeah.
When I'm struggling and when I'm trying to go, right, when I bore myself, like a lot of the times in sports journalism, you end up going on a treadmill from a match to a match to a match, from a week to a week to a week. And it's 3 months later and all your good intentions from the start of the year or all your good intentions from the last time you went on holiday and had a moment to sit and think are gone. Like you go, I'm gonna do a couple of big things. I'm gonna do some things that take a bit more time. And then you go, fucking no, I have to go and do this and I have to go and do that and I have to do a column for this and I have to do ghostwrite that and but anytime I do manage to sort of sit down and try and think, right, what would make a good idea? And I really struggle. I'm not good at ideas. Like I was of all the things I'm envious of Paul Howard for. I don't begrudge him his money. I don't begrudge him the fact that he managed to get out of sports writing and invent Ross O'Carroll Kelly and, you know, leave us all in his dust, because I still slag him that I think he does miss it. What I do begrudge, not begrudge, but I do envy more than anything, is just that idea factory.
Mm.
I wish I had that. That is the one, that is the biggest thing that I lack as a sports writer. I'm not good enough with taking the time to come up with ideas. Because if you have a good idea writes itself. No, it doesn't. No, that's wrong. It doesn't write itself, but it gets you into the position where you can do the thing you're good at.
Mm.
Like if you have a good enough idea that you came up with yourself, and I always find that's really important. Like I always find the work far more enjoyable if it's something that I've come up with rather than it's something the editor has gone, you should do something on that. Mm. And I think everybody's a little bit like that. Like I've so many times I find myself like knee deep in a piece that I'm doing and I'm going, oh God, I'm just not interested in this. And I have to slap myself up the backside of the head and go, well, if you had to come in with your own idea,
yeah,
this wouldn't have happened to you.
It's just, but like you say, elevator pitch, like it's one thing having the idea, but you know, it takes a lot to execute it. And absolutely, like tracking them down, like
it's the big thing. Once you're there, like put Paul Howard in that position. And like all he's got to do is really sit there and ask a few questions, but keep his eyes open. Because Paul's brilliance as a writer is his eye for detail. And he has such a brilliant eye and ear for little lines here that people say, little asides, like that, you know, there's a bit in this piece about, like, so it turns out that Daniel Tomofte is running a bar called Penalty.
Yeah.
Come on. In some no good mining town in the back arse of rural
deep in the feral heart of Transylvania, say Paul. That's the first line. So I was in from there.
Yeah. And so he's running this bar and it's a dive bar, you know, and there's a great line in it about how there's a broken window. And it turns out that, you know, the local football team were on the raz in there the night before and somehow a window got broken. And the guy is coming in sheepishly apologising to Danny Tomofte, about having broken his window. And I don't have the money to pay for it, but give me the measurements and I'll go and get the glass. And it's all this stuff. And it stayed with me forever, this piece, about just that. If you can get the idea, man, after that, it's up to you.
Yeah. I know it's kind of cliche at this stage, and maybe it's because it was widely publicised because he died in the last maybe 12 or 18 months, but Jimmy Breslin's idea of find your gravedigger.
Yeah,
like, it does kind of feel like that. And even like there's small little details from this in terms of the perspective from he tells it, because Tomofte doesn't get, like the word Tomofte doesn't appear for at least 600 or 700
yeah,
words.
Yeah, and funny, I was thinking that when I was reading this back there during the week.
Danny gets mentioned
before. Yeah, it's clearly a choice.
Which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, Paddy Bonner obviously gets mentioned beforehand. And little things like dropping in the fact that Ireland didn't win a match. Like, he's clearly, you know, that really hinds.
Whereas Romania beat Russia.
Yeah, I know.
You know, like, you totally forget that. And like, Tim Mofta is complete awe at the homecoming that Ireland got compared to the, you know, the Romanian fans were just short of spitting on them as it, when they got home.
And my favourite element of this show is effectively when guests come on and, for want of a better phrase, game recognises game. Thus it was when David Walsh came in the show. He talked about his pursuit of Lance Armstrong, naturally enough, but he also gave his props to an ingenious bit of investigative reporting on Lance by Damien Recio for L'Équipe.
Damien Recio was too bright to be a journalist, right? That's the first thing you have to say, because no journalist I know would have come up with this, right? He gets leaked information from the anti-doping lab in France. And the leaked information is, these are all the people who tested positive for EPO in the 1999 Tour de France, right? But all we have are numbers, because the anti-doping lab doesn't get names, it just gets numbers on the form, right? And there's loads of, I mean, it might have been 26 people. Now, there's a number of athletes there. But Damien is thinking, Armstrong would have been tested so much in that 1999 tour that there's a good chance that some of these numbers are his. But how does he find out? The people who have the numbers are the UCI. Their president at the time was Hein Verbruggen. Vice president was Pat McQuaid. They were in the business of protecting Lance Armstrong. They really, especially Hein Verbruggen, despise journalists, especially ones who wanted to investigate and find the truth. And Damien Recio, whom they would have really disliked his approach because he was so damn good, said, how do I do this? He said, Lance Armstrong, one of the things he didn't do in the Tour de France was apply for TUEs. Now, he got one retrospectively in 99, but he didn't actually go into the race with TUEs ever. It wasn't his style. He didn't do it. And Damien Recio said to Hein Verbruggen and to Lance Armstrong, I want to do a story saying that Lance rarely used TUEs. Right? And what I want is a record of Lance's doping control forms, copies of his doping control forms that I can use to show he never used TUEs. And they ring up Bill Stapleton, Armstrong's lawyer, and it says, journalist in France wants to write about the fact that Lance never used TUEs. And they all think it's a brilliant idea. This will show once and for all that Lance did it clean, which is their aim. And they supply Damien with all of Lance's doping forms. And now Damien has the name and the number together. And he has all the numbers of all the people who tested positive on retrospective testing. Because remember, in 99, there's no test for EPO. The French lab keeps the samples. When they get the test for EPO by 2005, well, they got it in 2000, at the Sydney Olympics 2000, and the Tour de France in 2001. So they have a very good test for EPO. But in 2005, the French lab goes back on the 99 samples and does a retrospective on all the samples. And they get all these positives, but they only have numbers. So Damien has all the numbers. Now the UCI give him all Lance's doping control forms and he just matches the numbers. And there's loads of positives that belong to Lance.
Wow.
It was just ingenious. And it was there then. You know, they could say they were duped and all of that. But what they couldn't say is these aren't Lance Armstrong's numbers. They couldn't say that because he had the documents. I thought it was ingenious and I loved that story. And to me, that was how anybody could have argued that Lance was clean after Damien Recio's story. Then you were trying to say that the earth was flat if you were trying to say that Lance was clean once Recio did his story. That was the single best story that anybody did in the Armstrong era. And Damien Recio can go to his grave happy that he achieved more with that story than most people in their entire journalistic lives.
The days of the iconic long-form US sports running feature may be waning as business model change and so forth, but they still come along every now and again, and this is how it was back in 2016 when ESPN's Roy Thompson turned up and wrote The Secret Life of Tiger Woods. Now, many of our guests have waxed lyrical about this feature across the series. Here's how Jonathan Liu of The Guardian composed his ode in an early episode.
Everybody thinks they know the Tiger Woods story. I think he won his last, well, until this year, won his last major in about 2008, 2009, I think, and then kind of succumbed to personal strife, injuries, and kind of a long, slow slide down the rankings. And what Wright Thompson does, who is a writer for ESPN, kind of in like unbelievably intimate detail, details that period, the fall and the nadir and the obsession that took over Tiger Woods during his kind of darkest period. He got really, really involved in like Marine SEALs combat training. He loved, you know, going to shooting ranges and firing shotguns. He actually went training with Marines, and all this was done in secret. And in this, I guess it's about 10,000 word piece, Wright Thompson posits that most of this stemmed from the loss of his father, who himself was, you know, served in the army, his father Earl, and the death of his father in, I think it was about, was it 2008, 2009? Oh no, slightly earlier than that, I think. Sent him into a kind of emotional spiral that ended up bringing down everything with it. So the reason I chose this piece, it's almost nostalgic, actually, to read a piece of journalism that has clearly taken him about 4 years to write and has been given like a budget of millions. Has been given like the budget of a Hollywood movie and, you know, probably a staff list of dozens. And it really kind of harks back to the, I suppose, what people would call the good old days of journalism, when you could just send somebody off for months and months and they would just come back with everything.
Is that what impressed you, like, journalistically about it? Just the level of detail in it?
I mean, it's good old fashioned reporting. You know, it's just hanging around outside his yacht in Bermuda and just watching people go in and out for, you know, 2 days. And, you know, I think about, you know, some of my, you know, assignments where I've got, well, you've got to write three pieces in the next 2 hours. I'm thinking, kind of wistfully, about, I wish I got to sit and watch a boat for 2 days. But you have to kind of justify that time and that investment with new stuff. And the amount of new stuff in that piece is just astonishing. Like towards the end, I think he knows Michael Jordan quite well. He just calls up Michael Jordan, so like, what do you think about all this? And Michael Jordan talks to him on the record and gives him some great quotes. It's just an incredible flexing of the muscles. That's what I liked about it, I guess.
Yeah, there's just so many like kind of almost like iconic details about Woods when he's on these trip with Navy SEALs, and then they sit down for dinner and the waitress brings over the check, and then everyone's waiting for Tiger to pick it up, and he just says nothing. He just blanks them.
Yeah.
And then someone eventually says, "Separate checks, please."
Yeah. I mean, he comes across as an incredibly human rogue, but a rogue nonetheless.
And
some incredibly intimate details of how, you know, the exact conversation that took place in the private jet going back home from his father's funeral. I mean, there's only like three or four people in the world that have the details of that conversation, that were privy to that conversation, and he's now one of them.
Yeah.
It's just a great piece of reportage.
And it's like, he also writes with a kind of a novelist sensibility, like Tiger staying up all night with his memories. The real work of his life has begun. That's how to deal with having been Tiger Woods. Like, he ends up acting out much of his father's life, like he was kind of with like prodigious infidelity. He just wanted someone around to witness the quieter moments of his life. Like, it really is exceptional. And I read it the first time when it came out. I thought, my God, that is
kind of definitive. Nothing else needs to be written about Tiger Woods.
Mm.
But now he's gone and won the Masters. And I'm like, I don't know how to feel about this piece now, because Tiger glimpses the little flashes of the life he threw away. Like, this is him like the end of this piece is him settling into the winter of his life. But he's still come back and won the Masters. Like, has that changed how you view this piece?
I guess so. I mean, I suppose he would argue that Tiger's success was always tied to his personal happiness in ways that we didn't really glimpse at for a long time, and I think to a greater extent than a lot of athletes. And you know, once he got his personal life settled and sorted, everything else sort of fell into place, and so it wasn't overly surprising that once he got his life sorted, he started winning golf tournaments again. But I suppose it did end on kind of a bleak note, didn't it? That does jar a little bit now. But I don't think it's kind of how remarkable that comeback was, that nobody really questioned it at the time. Nobody questioned this idea that, yeah, he was gone, he was finished, he'd busted himself. He'd busted his body. He'd busted his mind almost. And now he has come back. It all makes perfect sense. But that's the beauty of narrative, isn't it?
And brilliantly, Wright Thompson himself appeared on the show a couple of months ago to let some light in upon magic and talk us through just how he put that piece together.
I started out trying to do like Frank Sinatra Has a Cold. Like, I just would sort of show up to places where he was. And then I realized after a couple of months, I'm like, none of this is interesting. Like, this is not new. This is just the last thing the world needs is some kind of meta think piece, fucking, intellectual sort of theorizing about Tiger Woods. And so I was just like, the stakes are the bar to cross is 12,000 new words about Tiger Woods, or we need to go home. And so then, I mean, it sounds crazy. I just made a Excel spreadsheet and tried to account for every single day of his life in the 10 years between Earl dying and that Thanksgiving with the golf club and the fire hydrant.
What? So you plotted, hang on a minute. So you made a spreadsheet and you plotted what? His whereabouts or what he was doing on every day?
Yeah, tried to.
Oh my God, I thought there was a lot of work in it, but holy God.
Well, it was the only way I could figure out, just try to start seeing patterns, which is also where the Navy SEAL thing really came out, because there were huge unexplained absences, which is hard for someone that famous.
Yeah.
And so, and then the Navy SEAL thing, you know, we'd always heard rumors, but there was a photograph the Navy put out of him taking a tour somewhere. And there were some SEALs showing him stuff. And so I got every newspaper story that had ever been written that had the name of a SEAL in it and wrote it down. And then I got every book that had ever been written by or about SEALs. And I went through the acknowledgments and got all the names. And then I went and found phone numbers and email addresses. And, you know, you can search property records and LinkedIn and find people's resumes and whatever. And then I started sending out mass emails to people where I was just like, do you know anyone in this photograph? And then one of the guys named Tom wrote me back and was like, yeah, that's me. I'm two down from Tiger. And once you got one, you got another, and then another, and then another, and then another, and then another. I mean, that's an old school community that works only on letters of recommendation in an old fashioned sense. And like, you know, they didn't think Tiger was some national secret to keep. You know, the joke was we've kept bigger secrets than this. They thought it was funny, you know, and then it was literally just like, okay, Tiger was fishing. How many people would he have to interact with? There would be two deckhands on this boat. What was the name of the boat? Now let me go find, you know, LinkedIn resumes of people. Like, let me go find people who used to work on that boat, who now work somewhere else. Were you on the boat the day Tiger was there? No, but my friend Billy was. We talked about it. It was like that. It was trying to imagine every time you could figure out where someone was. Famous people constantly have strangers around, and they almost just get used to it. they have more witnesses to their lives than you could ever imagine. Mm. And so that was it. It was just looking for the witnesses. Anyway, I mean, that story, it was pretty funny. I finished that story. It ran. And then 2 days later, I flew to Leicester, England, because Leicester City was about to clinch. And I was fried, but I was like, I'll go over there and do this, go to a game. And then I don't know if you remember this, but they started losing. And then either Chelsea or Tottenham started winning. And I ended up stuck in the Leicester Marriott for like 23 days waiting on these sons of bitches to clinch. And I was exhausted and fried off of Tiger Woods. And it was just like, so my memory of it is that hotel and just being like, this is what happens. This is like, this is what, I'm stuck here. I won't ever leave here. But I just remember being like, this is unbelievable. Yeah. This was supposed to, you know, this was supposed to be 48 hours and a coronation. Now I'm still here.
What did you make of the reaction to the Tiger Woods piece? Because it blew up, obviously. Is it hard as a writer not to kind of lose the running yourself?
No, I mean, you're never as good as, you know, you're never as good or never as bad. I mean, I'm pretty good with that. I mean, you know, compare the reactions to Tiger Woods and Conor McGregor.
Yeah.
Do you know, that's part of the thing. You put something out in the world and then whatever happens next is what happens next. Right. I was already in Leicester working on the next thing.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know when it's done, it's done.
Leicester will grind you. All right.
Yeah. But you know what I mean? I like making them. I don't like, you know, I'm almost annoyed that I have to go out and, you know, promote them.
Yeah.
I'm ready to be doing the next thing, you know?
Okay. So we usually limit our guests to 4 picks. I've had 5 there. So I'd better call it quits at that. Thank you so much for listening. If you are new to the show, by the way, the entire archive is available to listen right now. So thank you again for listening to us and supporting us throughout an admittedly terrible year. But we will be back in 2021, thanks largely to your support. So I hope you do join us on the other side of New Year's Eve. Until then, Happy New Year and shine on.